It's very exciting to talk to you. You're a different audience from what we usually have or what we are normally used to have in giving talks to other people. Usually everybody starts to talk already. Okay, I'm gonna fall asleep. So you guys are fresh and more challenging, I hope, for me. You're gonna ask me lots of questions and don't let me get away with saying whatever I want. This is a silly question. Why is time always moving forward and never goes back? It's a silly question. It's a child's question. And if you want to know, this is why it's worth it to go through the boredom of high school and the boredom of undergrad and taking the tests and saying, yeah, I will learn, I will do the exercises, I will get the grades that you want me to get. Because at the end, if you're here, if you made it through all the boredom of teaching, you get to ask silly questions as an adult. So that's why it's worth it. That's why all the length of learning and going to classes and the exams, it's because you get to be silly at the end of it all. You've paid your dues, you got the grades, you got the fellowships, whatever it is that you do need to get higher. At the end, you get to ask stupid questions, your questions that nobody else has. So we'll start with that. I already said that's a silly question, a child's question. And I'm going to start with child's questions because you were a long time ago, I'm sure, but you were a child as well. And a lot of children's questions or stupid questions or obvious questions have no answer. And the question that I'm asking is an obvious question. Why is it always going forward? Because that's what it does. You can't ask it, but you get to ask it after all this trouble. So a child thinks in a different way. I've just had a baby about a year, a little bit more than a year ago. And I noticed, well, everybody knows this, but after about 3 months, when the baby's around 3 months old, it sees an object and it can direct his little arm and the elbow and the forearm to reach that object. What is the brain of the child doing at that time? It is solving Newton's equation of motion that you might all have learned with initial position, initial speed, and an acceleration in order to direct the arm to go there. The brain of a newborn baby is the best scientist that we have because it is trained and programmed to read and absorb the world. And that after a couple of months, it can solve a differential equation to get to the object. That's just the first thing that a child does. So what am I saying this? Because as adults, you need to protect your child's brain. Don't listen too well to what you're taught. You need to write the exam and you need to get the right answers, but you can't take that too truly. You need, later on, you're gonna have to forget it all. So protect your own questions. Any one of you is going to be told your question is silly. Your question is obvious. Your question is childish. Keep at it. Try to not pay so much attention to the textbook and listen to what your child's brain is telling you inside. So I said this already. There's a way in which the child's brain studies nature that as grown-ups, and because we have learned so much, we forget to do it. We forget how to do it, how to study nature. And this is my message, that you will keep that ability to study nature as a child. We enter a tunnel when we start getting taught, and we come out at the other way after an undergrad or a PhD, and we are so taught, so well articulated, armed with tools, but we lost the best tool, which is the child's thinking. The result, and this is why it's exciting for me to talk to you, is that you get scientists who are followers. They forgot how to think. They can only read in a textbook and forgot their own opinion, their own questions. They learn the questions that are taught to them in textbooks by other scientists. And this is not what we need in science. So here are two types of science. The first type, we call it incremental science. It's like climbing a hill. And you can imagine a mountain of knowledge in whichever field. And each climber learns the mountain of knowledge. And when they get to the top, they add their little bit, their contribution to the mountain of knowledge. That's called incremental science, because you add a little bit to the established mountain that exists already. That's a type of science. Another type of science is this guy. He comes down the mountain, or doesn't go up it, crosses the valley without knowing what they're going to find, and they start a new mountain of their own with their new ideas. Either you find or you found your own ideas in a mountain. This is a lot more difficult just because it requires more courage. A lot of people are going to tell you, where are you going? This is the mountain that you should be climbing. And so it's an act of courage. You need to go out without knowing what you're going to find, and you will start a field with your own questions, even if people tell you that's not a worthy question to ask. As I have been told many times with my question, why is time moving forward? So this guy, the valley crosser, is more difficult. It requires courage, but it's a way lot more fun. It's why you keep doing science. And I can give an example for me. I'm a scientist, but I like mountaineering. I like to go skydiving. There's a lot of other things outside of science that I like. So there has to be a reason for me to be here every day doing science instead of going out and doing the all other things that I love. And that is, you do science because you cannot live without it. It's not that you have a choice. If you do exactly what you believe and your questions and make science personal, you will not be able to live without it, because it's your questions. You make it personal. It's your own. You have made it about you and not about the textbook. So that is why it's more fun even if it's more difficult to cross the valley. So this I already said, protect the child's brain, develop your intuition. Doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. What is nature telling you? A lot of students that I get as postdocs, as PhD students, they tell me beautiful things expressed in beautiful math. And then I say, what do you think? And the student is able to, I read in this book that it's like this in electromagnetism and general relativity. Okay, but why do you like this? What is your opinion? I don't care if it's right or wrong. I want to hear you speaking. So this is a problem with physics, particularly math. Math is just a language. And if you learn a lot of math, you might forget what it is that you are studying, which is this. Nature, reality. And I have an analogy to explain what's the difference between math and nature, which is the subject of physicists. Now I'm gonna say this first. So math is a language, and to understand an idea, any idea, you have to be able to explain it with your hands, not with math. If you haven't understood an idea, if you cannot explain it without making appeal to technical terms. And no matter how difficult the math is, if you want to understand a subject really well, try to keep the math out and explain it to somebody else. And I'm saying this because so many members of the public, when I give outreach talks, tell me, I like the universe. I like cosmology. I like the Big Bang. How did it all begin? I loved it at university, but I couldn't understand the math. And I say, well, the math is just a language. You don't need the math. It's just a way to speak to each other. So here's an analogy. What is the math for? Imagine that you're writing poetry. If the math is just the grammar, why you write poetry. If you don't have the physicist or yourselves, you cannot write poetry. Math is just the language. So the important part in science is your own personality and not the language in which you are expressing it. Tell your friends this. I'm sure you guys are all good at math because you got here and you must have good grades. A lot of your friends at school are not good at math, and they think or are made to believe that math is difficult, therefore you can't understand the world. Math is just a language. And if ever in your life a scientist comes to you and says, I can't explain to you because it's very mathematical. You say, I know, it's very mathematical. You could work at it harder. You need to understand it a bit better if you can't explain it without the math yet. So don't overthink about the math. And this is the other thing that I wanted to tell you. Obviously, you are good students, and you are, you have good grades, or you are interesting, you wrote nice things to get here. But there is a time, so as you progress in education, you get put in higher and higher levels, or groups, you pass towards groups of people who are smarter and smarter. And there will come a time, at PhD or already at university or afterwards, where you are in a group of people so smart that they are all smarter as smart as you or smarter. That's inevitable. You know, you all pass filters, go up and up and up. You get better grades, you go to an Ivy League university. There will be a time, no matter when, that you look around and everybody is as smart as you or smarter. So the question at that time is, how will you stand out? Smartness is just like math. It doesn't make a scientist. What will make you unique when you are in that group where everyone is already smarter than you or had better grades or learned the textbooks better is your unique questions. And it's what will make you succeed and be different from others and be a good scientist. It's not going to be easy because a lot of people say, well, you ask the same question as somebody else. But your unique questions and the things you are sticking about yourself that you have about nature, that you see and interact, and the questions that you feel you've had for a long time are the things that will give you the extra edge at that time when smartness no longer does it. So feel the questions you have. Don't think about it. Questions that you can't escape or that you have, like why is time always moving forward? Feel them. Thinking is the worst thing you can do. Just make the questions your own. And this is the last slide about this is something we were taught in dance, that there will always be a dancer who jumps higher, who turns faster, who spins better, but nobody has your eyes. And transported to physics is there will always be someone who's smarter, who knows more, who read more textbooks, but nobody has your questions and your way, your child's way of interacting with reality and with the world around you. So keep that. Right, so why is time moving forward? Like I say, this is something which is obvious. You cannot escape. Everywhere you look, time is moving forward. No matter what you're doing with your lives, time is the most striking fact of nature. It's unavoidable. I don't remember my dinner today. Physics, most of physics, has no answer for why. Well, nobody has an answer for why time's moving forward, not just physics. But physics should have. And it is inconvenient. I'm not going to address this right away, but I'll talk about it. So physics compared to other disciplines. In chemistry, they would never say that time is not moving forward because they have reactions that they only go one way. Biology, there's a baby and an old guy. Time's moving forward, not backwards. Paleontology, if they said that time goes both ways, as physics sometimes does, they would see fossils of the future. They would have to see fossils as well of the future. Climatology, this is a bit more tricky, more technical, but the arrow of time is so present in climatology and forecasting the weather that you can't escape it as well. But the majority of equations that physicists write down are time symmetric. That means that time can go both ways, forward or backward. So it would seem that there's nature, and physicists are just, you know, hunched over the desk writing, and they don't want to hear what nature is shouting out loud, that there is an arrow of time. So the past in most of the equations, you know, GR, you've just been taught this morning, electromagnetism, all atomic physics, all microphysics are all time symmetric, meaning time can go forward or backward. So what we do is we throw out by hand half of the solutions. We solve the equations, we get solutions, and time can go up or down. And we just discard by hand half of those. And I will tell you what that means. So there's a lot of jabber in this slide. Look at this image. There's a rock which is falling in a pond. The rock creates some ripples, and the ripples propagate out to the margins of the pond. Obvious. What physics is telling you when it says the equations are time symmetric is the following. Just as the rock is dropped onto the pond, it creates a circular ripples that propagate out to the margin, normal. The margin could start to conspire and make some waves, some ripples that propagate to the center of the pond. When they reach the center, out pops a rock upwards. Have you ever seen something like this? Do you think it's okay? It's not very natural or normal, right? That's what physics is saying. The equations that we have to describe not only the pond, but GR and electromagnetism say that it is just as likely that the rock falls on the pond, creates ripples, the ripples go out to the margins, is just as likely and possible and exists in nature as the margin starting to conspire spherical waves. Waves go on to the bottom, to the center, and pop, eject a rock upwards. No difference, no explanation why we see one and not the other. The equations are exactly, give exact same weight to these two solutions. What do? Pick up the solutions that say the rock goes up in the air and put them under the rug. So that's what everybody does. This I read this in Roger Penrose's book or an article. Who here knows Roger Penrose or has heard of Roger Penrose? Okay. He visited here 1 month or two, three months ago. It was a revelation for me. He was so much like a child in his way of thinking that I thought, my God, he's 87 years old. He turned up in here. I was having a meeting in an office with him and Lee Smolin, and we were trying to explain to him our new version of GR, and with very expensive mathematics. And he goes in the middle of it, like, because Lee is very knowledgeable in all types of formulations of GR. You can explain it in very different ways with very different math. And he said, "What do you want? Do you want me to explain it in first order formalism and second order with higher derivatives?" And Roger Penrose goes, no, forget about the math. What is the idea? Give me the idea. And you know, Roger Penrose invented half of the math that we have available and study, and you know, everybody in this building knows very well what he's made, what he's written and developed. So to have this giant of intellectual humankind to say, just forget about the mass, give me the idea. That was really a revelation for me. So he writes things like this. These are obvious facts that it's so obvious that the rock falls on the pond, not the pond throws the rock up, that that's why we overlook them. And that's why we need a child's brain to come and say, wait, but that's ridiculous. So that's what we say then when I said we discard the solutions, the arrow of time. The passing of time is not real. It's an illusion. Now I will say what it means to you. But does anyone feel like the passing of time is an illusion? Does it not feel real to you? Do you feel like you're frozen somewhere and, you know, it's just like it's like a dream that time is passing? It feels real to me. I find it a very important fact of interacting with reality. So it's an illusion because it doesn't exist at the microscopic level. And that's what I said about sweep the other solutions under the rug. And that's where the cosmology, which is what I do, the science of the universe, is gonna come in. So you say, the pond, the rock has fallen into the pond because of initial conditions. I chose to have a rock holding a rock in my hand above the pond and drop it. So I, after the rock is dropped, I study it, and I don't know who put the rock there or how it got there. It's initial conditions. That's why the margins of the lake don't conspire to bring the rock upwards. Fine. It's initial conditions. But everybody is doing the same in science. Like I said, every time we say, I don't know why the rock, why the lake doesn't put the rock up. It's initial conditions. I don't know. I throw out the other solutions because somebody, before I started my experiment, put the rock there. And so everybody keeps on adding onto this pile, and it becomes bigger, and somebody will pay the bill. Some people whose job it is to explain how the universe appeared, because it's in the initial conditions, if you keep pushing further and further back, at some point you're going to reach the Big Bang, where there are no initial conditions. You have to explain the initial conditions. That's where time started. So it's all very nice for a bunch of scientists to say, oh, I don't know. The rock was there. Out of my field of study, the rock was up, and then it fell, and then I have my equations. Great. But there's some guys that have to explain that there will be a point, you keep pushing the explanation backwards and backwards, and then you reach the beginning of the universe. And then that's your job. You have to explain the initial conditions at the Big Bang. And that's a big, big problem, which, by the way, Roger Penrose accounted for very well. So this is typical things. I think you had a talk by Ghazal Geshyani last week. So she's my kind of person. We do the same kind of things. This is, I don't know if she showed this plot or not. This is universe, galaxies, formation of stars, a little period we call as dark ages, something, I don't know if you will hear about, really cool, the cosmic microwave background, light coming at us from the Big Bang, from every angle. Best way we have to know what's happening at the Big Bang. Accelerated expansion here, and then there's this spot there. As you can see, there's no pushing back over there to explain, I don't know, the rock just appeared there because there's no more time. And so cosmologists have to explain the Big Bang and have to pay the bill for everyone who's been putting on pile under the rug. So, if the Big Bang, like I said, is explaining galaxies, how did planets form, how the first structures of matter, is the microwave sky, really cool. But here's the problem. If the first instance of time have to account for the arrow of time being an illusion, which is put upon the Big Bang by all the scientists, it's practically impossible to explain by that time the pile has gotten so large that you can no longer explain how it began. And is in the likelihood, the probability that the Big Bang happens under those conditions that you have to explain the arrow of time is really small. This is just something to do with black holes. Doesn't have any black holes in here, but I can explain. This is, you're going to account what's the likelihood of at the beginning of the universe. So basically what we do is, that first number is the number of degrees of gravity. It comes from accounting how much entropy is in a black hole in the middle of each galaxy. That's all. So it's black holes are very, very massive in terms of entropy. There's a formula for it, but it's not very important. Then this is basically the number of particles in the universe. And so you multiply the number of particles by the number of degrees of freedom, and you get 10 to the 80 times 10 to the 21, you get this in terms of entropy. Entropy is more or less a measure of the disorder that you make when you say the arrow of time just goes one way. So if the arrow of time just goes one way for many years, which is our universe is 14 billion years, then the amount of entropy that you have to explain is going to be very large. And so this is the amount of entropy, and the likelihood is just you invert that. And so the likelihood of the Big Bang is one part in this number, 10 to the 10 to the 100, which I have no idea what that means. It's so large that, I mean, I invite you or I invite anyone to say how big that is. It's not that it's, there are, there's not 1,000 or 10,000 here. There's 100 zeros exponent in the 10. It's impossible for cosmologists to explain that. So what we do sometimes is come up with easy answers. Because we come to cosmology to understand the galaxies, how the universe grows, etc. And so we come up with answers saying there are other universes out there that we don't see and we don't understand, but they are going to explain the initial conditions. This is very dodgy. They'll never be observed, and you can explain pretty much anything. You can say, well, I didn't fall off this podium right now. Lucky me, but there's somebody else in another universe who is falling off. And so you explain the reason of saying, I didn't fall off this podium. Why didn't I fall off this podium and hurt myself? By saying, well, if you hurt yourself, then probably you'd be in the hospital and you're not here. So that's how come you're giving a talk. It's kind of, it's not really science. I'm not doing justice to it, but it's kind of as if you're explaining science by saying, why something like this? Well, there are many universes, and in the other universes, it is another way. And it is like this because that's what you're observing. It's a bit silly. But this is an important thing that I don't know, I'll check about time how we're doing, but this is an important thing which comes from if people tell you that time is an illusion or the progress of time is an illusion. And it comes from Einstein, who was brilliant. And, you know, I think GR for me is the most beautiful mathematical theory ever that anyone made. But this is GR, the block universe of Einstein. It means that, so Einstein unified space and time. And we call it a four-dimensional block of space and time. Because the equations are time symmetric, so time goes forward and backwards equally, and the passing of time is an illusion, what that leads is to something like this. It's a block, a four-dimensional block, so you just have to imagine that there is one extra spatial dimension, and we are here, like right now, giving this talk. And so you could imagine stepping out of this block and saying, and looking at us, giving a talk, and then you could maybe look a bit towards the left earlier in time, and you could look at yourselves having tea and cookies downstairs about 1 hour ago. And then you could also say, well, I can look a bit more towards the future. And you'd be able to see your afternoon today or tomorrow. Now, if you were outside of the block, then you could choose to see the entire time. You could go see the dinosaurs here or see what's going to happen tomorrow in your life or for the rest of your life. That's okay, that's nice. But so what that picture says, and it's a result from time symmetry in physics, is that the passing of time is an illusion. The future, as well as the past, has already happened. So your future has already happened. You're not doing anything special right now. Nothing of what you do, studying harder to get better grades or, you know, training to run faster or whatever it is that you want to do makes no difference because the flow and the progression of time is an illusion. Your future is already happening. You think you have free will, the choice of what you're going to do now, but that's an illusion. And so we are more or less puppets in the block who believe that they are going and have agency, or you can choose, have choice, but you don't. The problem with this, for me, as well as all the other problems that time symmetric physics brings, is that why shouldn't, if everything that I do will not matter, why don't I just go home and lay on the couch and watch movies? Because it's already written anyway. It's already, all my future is already here. So why should I try to work harder or to, you know, reach for anything? Because it's already determined. I just don't know it yet. What will be. So a lot of physicists have a problem with this. And this is, you know, it comes from the equations. Not only does the pond eject the rock, but we're saying to people, you are all puppets in a time that has already happened. The flow of time is not real. It's not a good message as scientists to pass to the public. And it's not a good message for ourselves. Oh, so this is, there's a site at the University of Cambridge that makes explanations of questions like these events, does time pass or not? They asked me a lot of questions a couple of years ago about more or less what I'm saying about the blocked universe. If you want to go and check it out, there's some interviews and stuff. So finally, do I have like 15 minutes? How much time do I have?
We have until 2. So, but that is also meant to be time for questions too, but.
Okay, who's close to falling asleep?
Yeah.
Raise your hands, come on. Okay, so let's take a few slides to show if you want to start changing this, what do you do? Because a lot of the physics that is time symmetric, and so reversal of under variations of the arrow of time, has been proven and has been experimented on. So you have to put the arrow of time very, very, very deep in the foundations of physics that it has not been yet studied. Let me just see if I want to say this. I guess what I'm saying is this. If you want to have to make science where the flow of time exists and is a reality, not an illusion, you have to go deep in the foundations of physics to put it. So I wrote this paper with Lee Smolin, and it starts to do what I'm going to say. So put the arrow of time in the foundations. And I want to refer to these because it's an example of what I was saying earlier. Remember when I was saying, everybody's going to tell you that's a stupid question, that's a silly question, it's obvious, it's already been answered, or that doesn't matter. When I was writing this paper with Lee, which is the first paper that we wrote on this program, I was walking around these corridors here at the building, and I would say, you know, Lee, like, everyone is going to laugh at us because we have put this out. I was terrified. Lee Smolin is a famous figure. He has written many books, and his career would be safe. So I said, you know, your career is safe, but I am going to go be fired and be laughed at, and, you know, that's the end for me. So that's the thing in courage and believe your questions. All of the sudden, after we put this book, I got an email from this guy, you have won a cosmology prize. What? And then this prize didn't exist at that time. So, and he said, give me your bank account details and I will transfer the money. He's like, okay, this is a scam. So now you're going to want me to give you $2,000 so that you then can give me $100,000 back or something. So I didn't even believe it of it at the beginning. And Lee also, he got the same emails, just some spam. But the example, the important message is this. I was terrified to put this paper out because I thought I was going to lose my job. And people liked it. And in the end, it came to a prize. So it's and the prize is not so much the point of it. The point is that if you take joy and believe and you have your own questions, you're going to have fun and you're going to end up putting the paper out. And that's the goal. And you will feel like you're doing something which comes from deep inside you because it's your own opinion that you're putting out. Anyway, so we're going to the foundations of physics where I'm going to already say you are bringing general relativity together with quantum gravity. So at the very beginning of the universe and at the very smallest scales, and you put the arrow of time there. So quantum gravity is the biggest problem in physics. I don't know if it's the biggest problem, but it's big. It's where you try to reconcile the physics of the very large, general relativity, with the physics of the very small, quantum gravity. And so everyone, a lot of people in this building are working on quantum gravity, and if you want to build a theory of time, you go to that regime, to the very small regime of physics, and you say at that regime that the equations are time asymmetric. And you say instants of time are the building blocks of nature, the Lego pieces of nature. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but essentially this is a network, more or less, of how it happens, how it works. These are events, so time passing. And these are, you can imagine that there are two photons interacting. So every time two photons interact, you say that's an event. You say that time has passed, and it has passed in a way that it cannot be unpassed. So events happen, and they can never unhappen, which makes sense. And the way you do it is by making sure in the equations, pass that, pass that, pass that, pass that. It's just mass, isn't it? There's nothing to it. I can explain very well what this is. I'm not going to explain, but it's, don't get scared. You have in quantum gravity, this is actually something you can explain very well, so you can understand, so I'm going to explain it. Quantum gravity is a regime where there's no space, and there's no quantum mechanics, and there is no space-time in the way that Einstein thought about it. So you have to build space-time out of those Lego pieces, out of those blocks. And you have to show how space emerges. And so you can see here, just think of these two numbers. And then here, this is one number. And this here, this is another two numbers. So if you imagine these are two, an interval of space, this is a velocity, and this is an interval of time. So if you put this interval to the denominator here, you've got an interval of space divided by an interval of time is a velocity. That's easy. So that's the emergence of space-time. That comes from that network that I was showing you, this. And we have put the irreversibility of time, let me just go back. The irreversibility of time, so the arrow of time, is done in that the equations have an ingredient of randomness. Something is drawn by luck, and you know that you can never reverse something that has been drawn out of dice, by rolling dice, more or less. So this is the last slide. The first thing, well, the one before last. So the thing which is important is that if you put the arrow of time deep in quantum mechanics and general relativity in quantum gravity, you have to show how does that arrow of time, which is apparent there, it needs to give rise to the equations that we know that look to be time symmetric. And so we did some simulations. I'm just going to, this is the last slide. I'm just going to explain this more or less. This is a plot. Each of these points that you see here is an event of that other network that I had shown you. The time coordinate is here, and that's the x, the space coordinate. And the important thing to take away from this plot is that we've shown that this part of the plot, you see there's a lot of disorder, irregular, no structure, very like random events. And they interact, start to interact by a rule that we have, which is time asymmetric. And at the end, there's a phase, kind of this line I just put there. There's a phase where the lines after that start to become regular, ordered. They have like a regular succession or trajectories. So this is just the mechanism by which you know you can put the flow of time at the beginning in the equations over there. And we have shown that you can then make something which still appears to be time symmetric, but keeps the flow of time underneath. So it's this plot that will tell you that it's okay to believe that the flow of time exists and it is not an illusion. And then that's it.
So you say that time is ordered based on particle interactions. So when there is a particle interaction, that is an instant of time advancement. But in order for these particle interactions to occur, doesn't that already assume there's some sort of arrow of time built in which allows the particles to travel to these points of interaction?
Yes, yeah, that's a good question. Let me just see how I can answer that. The particles are traveling, and I said that they're traveling as a kind of to make it more understandable. But those particles live in this space with just energy, and so they just interact, and those events of time are the thing which is going to create the flow of time. However, you're right that we are putting causality there by saying, you know, they first are traveling together and then are interacting. So one comes after the other, and that's completely right. So it is not an answer to why causality exists. So the particles first travel and then meet. But it is a way to say that it is not an illusion.
So what you showed is not why time exists, but why time is irreversible?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yes, exactly. I wish I had shown why time exists. Yep.
Okay, so I have kind of two questions in one. Mm-hmm. The first question could you postulate the idea, like, is the entropy of the universe increasing? And if it is, could you postulate the idea that the increase in entropy is causing the accelerated expansion of the universe?
Good question. Entropy of the universe is increasing. That is one rule. If there's one rule of physics that you can never violate, it's the entropy rule. The acceleration of the universe has been recently put together with the entropy question. Only in the way that it increases the amount of entropy that exists in the universe by this formula called the black hole entropy, more or less is what it doesn't explain it. But the fact that the universe is accelerating does increase the entropy that we need to explain at the Big Bang. Why the entropy is increasing, that's why I took the trouble to explain to you at the beginning that you need to think for yourselves, because there is no question, there is no answer to that. And I thought if I make them believe that they need to, you know, they can listen to their own minds, they might solve that problem. That would be a big why the entropy increases, why time goes forward? No, no, no clue. You and then you.
Oh, okay. I had a question about, so if, I guess, time is, in a sense, a flow, and that's going one direction, but it's more so like connection or network of events, as you described
mm-hmm.
it. And at the like most fundamental level, it would be like, as you were talking about, like quantum gravity
yeah.
and quantum interactions, that would imply that it's probabilistic. And so would like, space-time kind of corrupts at that point where it's just like a cloud of probability in a way.
Yeah.
Do you feel like, how does that scale up, or do you have any idea of like how that can scale up and impact like more macroscopic things?
Very, very, very good question. That's exactly the topic of a grant proposal that Lee Smolin and Andrew Liddell and a bunch of other people are working on right now. So there is one, this is my opinion, and I think other people, well, Roger Penrose has also thought about this, that that arrow of time or that probabilistic cloud can be at work in your brain, in our brains. So the brain is such a complex object to study in physics that we have no clue how to understand it. And I believe, and I think physicists believe, that one day we'll be able to study the brain as a physical object. My own personal opinion is that it will be 10 centuries, 1,000 years before we are able to study the brain. But the suspicion is that the brain does exactly know that type of physics that exists at the quantum level, and it can make its own decisions or use that physics to process and make computations, and who knows what else. That's a fascinating subject, and that's exactly what we are doing right now. We want to take the reversibility of time and extend it to quantum biology. So that's what you call it, just a name. Quantum biology and the brain. May time irreversibility explain the complexity that exists in the structure of the brain.
As in, like, conscious?
Yes.
Oh, that's really...
Yeah, consciousness, yeah. Consciousness is... You know, we kind of have a little... put it outside, because you don't know what it is. I'm not at that field. It's very complicated, and I know that I cannot touch it. But it is... That's... In at least 10 centuries, we will be able to understand the brain, my opinion, but that's so important. Study your own brains. I study my brain all the time. by you know, seeing how it works. Why is the child a better physicist? Because he hasn't learned any rules, didn't learn any textbooks. The child is prepared, is made by the brain to study reality. So the brain knows more than we do. And as a scientist, a lot of the good breakthroughs come when you stop thinking and just let the brain act freely, make the connections in your brain, and it will give you the answer. That's why I said, don't think. A lot of things, the brain is just working without you knowing, it's going to give you the answer. I let it, don't make it happen, something like that. The brain is fascinating, and yeah, I hope we can make some progress. And then it was you, yeah.
So, So in physics, a lot of things are described using mathematics. And then in the beginning, you were saying that the math that we had for this physics seemed reversible. What's to say that we always have a perfect mathematical analog for physical phenomenon?
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, exactly. The problem why physicists are so keen on time symmetric equations is that we, of all the scientists, the physics are the ones who have a very good sense of beauty or aesthetics. And so it's like we are closet mathematicians. And so what you do when you look at a theory, your aesthetic mathematical brain is saying, oh, it's beautiful, is it elegant, is it not elegant? And so what happens is that we want the world to behave as our math tells the world to behave, and kind of forget that it's supposed to be the other way around. It's the world that is teaching us. We are studying the world. It's not the world we're studying mass. It's we are studying reality. And so nothing says that we have the mass to study the universe and reality and nature. And we always need to be alert that the equation that explains the phenomena that we are looking for might not be beautiful or might not be what we thought. It's very, very difficult. And it's kind of a commonplace to say, oh, physicists have to be able to give up their beliefs if the outcome of the experiment doesn't prove it. It doesn't happen like that. We all have intuitions or beliefs or tastes, and it's very difficult to keep the taste and the aesthetic outside of the equations that you write down. So that's a good question. There is no guarantees that we have the right mass yet.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about the entropy of the universe, and you said it was a measurement you make if the arrow of time goes one way.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, you also mentioned that entropy, like one of the laws of physics is that entropy is increasing, which would denote, again, a notion of time.
Mm-hmm.
So if we think about more of Einstein's explanation of how time actually, like all of the events are real at the same instance,
yeah.
How can we explain entropy?
So how all the if the past and the future have already happened,
yeah,
there's no answer.
Increasing.
Yeah, yeah. So what you do if you accept that view is that you say, okay, the explanation of entropy is then all shoved right back to the initial conditions. In that view, in all the GR and electromagnetism and microscopic physics or atomic physics, there is no answer for the arrow of time and for entropy.
Because the fact that it, like the law that it is increasing would also be broken because all of them are now in the same instance.
Yeah.
All of the events.
So what happens, what you say is that you say those are microscopic physics. GR, that's all microscopic physics. And then when you coarse grain, they call it coarse grain, to zoom out to larger scales, you can see what you would call thermodynamics, where entropy is visible and unavoidable. So you would say in GR, we are not at the scale, physical scale of thermodynamics. So you're not worried about entropy. And I believed that for many years, and I thought, but I still don't understand it. and that we had a physical statistician visit here, that is expert in thermodynamics, and she told Lee and I that that there is no proof for how the thermodynamics appears when you coarse grain, what I was saying, which is something all physicists believe and why they can do their GR time symmetric way. But she explained, in the field, there is no proof for how you get the arrow of time if you just start from a timeless frozen description. Huh?
Okay, so it seems like historically there are quite a few physicists that end up being religious towards a later life. So I'm just wondering if you happen to know why that is, or and whether you yourself believe in God.
What was the first part of the question?
So
some physicists are religious.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering if you happen to know why, like that seems to be the case, and whether you yourself believe it.
Oh, do I believe in God? I don't know. So I want to say this very clear. There is no problem with religion. I mean, I think there's so many things in physics which are not explained that if in your life you choose to believe in God or believe in whatever you want to believe, there's lots of spaces where God can be acting because we don't know the answer. So if you wanted to, if you're keen to having religious beliefs, you could say, God, I have a figure of God in my talk. That is a drawing made by, again, Roger Penrose. That's God. So, I mean, he didn't say that he's God, but you can imagine that in the initial conditions, the problem is so big that you, in order to explain it, you would have to believe in God because he created the universe exactly, very finely and accurately, and in the exact way that gives that entropy over there, one in one part in 10 to the 10 to the 100. So there is no incompatibility. If you were keen to having a religious belief, for example, this is a way in which God could be there. I don't know if I believe in God. I don't have religious tradition, but I also don't agree that science is the enemy of religion. There's so many things that you, there's so many good people, good thinkers that you lose if you say religion is the worst thing that can come into the building, that that's not a good thing. So plenty of space to be a scientist and to believe in God. The kind of problem is that if you want to make the teachings of the Bible true, that's going to be very difficult because there's a lot of evidence that what is written there is not true. But then, that it's a book. So, sorry, was somebody else? Yeah.
So, is there anything that contradicts the irreversible flow of time that you suggested through?
Anything that contradicts it? No. There's nothing that contradicts the irreversible flow. It'd be great if something contradicts the irreversible.
Explained by a possible circle. Not having the irreversible flow, like this physical observation.
That contradicts that time is not flowing forward. Yeah, that's the problem. There's nothing. If there was something, then we could all go home and continue doing our beautiful GR and atomic physics and quantum gravity. The problem with most of the physics, if you study hard enough with quantum mechanics as well, is that the time flows. And that gets into your theory. And then there's, yeah. Oh, sorry, you asked the question already. Let's just see if there was somebody, yes.
It's kind of a weird question, but so like, how do we know that time isn't actually flowing back before, like when breakfast is the actual last meal of the day, and then the Big Bang was actually like the end of the year?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good question. That's, we don't know. You could call breakfast dinner and, you know, say that we are going backwards, but and so we go backwards, and that's when we grow old. That's an interpretation. And but the thing that which is important is that there is one direction. You don't grow old and become a baby, and then grow old and become a baby. You go in one direction. And so that's unavoidable. That's the key. There's many quantities. Just as time is always increasing, there are quantities which are always decreasing. They have one direction as well. So that's that. That's the key. That arrow. Okay. Is it almost? Yeah.
Oh, I'm very interested in what you were speaking about with Calipus and Peale of mathematics and getting lost too much in the math.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you, and I think that, if, yeah, we can't rely too much on that, if we're speaking to detach from reality. But I was wondering, because I feel like there has been revolutions in the past that have kind of been insights of math, like, you know, like black holes and like antiparticles, and kind of like there has been like these, like, I don't know, insights, I guess, is what I was saying, in the math that we wouldn't have.
Yeah.
Naturally had intuition to assume our
yes, yes, yes. So in the past, there's hints written down in the theory or in the mathematical description that we have come up with, found new solutions that the physical world hadn't shown us yet. And so that's beautiful. And, you know, having seen that black holes have our solution of GR way before we discover that, it's really beautiful. And so it's not that you should throw away math altogether, because it is the language that we use to talk to each other. The problem is don't follow the trail of the math without keeping touch. Because even black holes, I mean, in the future, we're going to understand them better. Black holes contain a singularity in the middle, in the center, right? Singularity of energy density. And that can't exist in nature. So there's something, there's some new physics happening inside a black hole that the mathematics doesn't describe to us. So the regime where GR gives the black hole is what we would call quantum gravity. Because but it breaks down there. So the mass doesn't give all the description, and you need new physics to describe what's going on exactly at the center of the black hole. So mass is a fantastic language that we have, but we need to keep the ideas. It like that story I was saying is like the poetry without the poet. Math is the language, but you have to keep your own feel for what it is that you are saying and be able to say it without the math. So express the ideas and don't, you know, if the math isn't beautiful, then that doesn't mean that it's not true. That's the most important message, I think. Can I?
So is that number there, the 1 in 10 to the 10 to the 101, is that just the Big Bang? So does that mean the Big Bang is unlikely? What we believe to be the beginning of our universe is very unlikely to have occurred.
Yeah. And that's the consequence of the time symmetric physics.
Time's okay.
Like the pile under the rug, remember? It gets bigger and bigger. That's how big it is, that number that I don't know what it is. Okay, and now you, and then you, and you have. Did you ask a question already? Okay, then. So 1, 2, yeah.
It's actually kind of that's what the physicists usually have. we'd rather feel that it kind of is a contribution to physics or science in general, or does it rather kind of hurt it because it might keep or might make people kind of keep clinging to something that necessarily isn't beautiful, but they kind of keep searching for kind of more aesthetic version, which probably doesn't exist.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. This is being recorded, so I need to be careful with what I say. How can I answer that? Sense of aesthetics. It's important to have it, or it's unavoidable to have it. But some of the math is a bit complicated, and you need somebody who has a mathematical brain to understand it and work and play with it. The problem is somebody who has a mathematical brain, he has a sense of aesthetics. So if I could, I would replace love of aesthetics by love of nature. If you're really passionate about understanding what goes on, around you, you won't mind to pay the price of the beauty or a simplicity or elegance. There is this philosopher of science, you're young for this, but look it up. His name is Paul Feyerabend. And he would always say that simplicity, elegance, and beauty are never necessary conditions for scientific practice. So he would say, you should try all theories and pay attention to all of them, even if they're ugly or inconsistent or they're not simple. If they you should try, it's almost like an anarchy in science that he wanted. Everything that clashes with the big mountain of knowledge should be taken seriously. Because if the mountain of knowledge is wrong, and you're only going to keep adding onto the mountain of knowledge, you're never going to get anything, you're never going to correct it. And we've seen this in the Copernicus, when Copernicus shifted the view of the skies by putting the sun in the center. That was one such example. Everybody believed the Earth was at the center, and all the planets rotated around it. We made the theories more and more complicated to kind of make sense of the heavens in which the planets were rotating around the Earth. And it was a theory that clashed completely with that existing mountain that came to improve and completely radical our view of the universe then. So in cosmology, for example, right now, we have a problem very much like this, which I don't know if Ghazal told you, that we have the dark energy, we have the dark matter, the dark radiation, all these components in the universe that we keep adding onto it. They are a little bit like the epicycles that at that time people kept adding onto the planets to explain that the Earth was at the center. It didn't look very good. It was more and more complicated. And for us, it's also the same. Every time we add a new dark component to the universe, and we really, really, really need a Copernicus that comes and say, no, hold on, that's all wrong. The Earth, the sun is in the center. So that's a similar situation with what we have right now. And in cosmology, we really need someone to come and say that there's another way to view things. Okay, so who was next? You were next.
I wanted to ask, see with entropy, basically the distribution of energy, like in a system. So, with entropy, it's basically the distribution of energy in a system. Mm-hmm. So there is a chance that the energy, I don't want to say.
Yeah, continue.
entropy and time will be related in a way.
Yes.
So why would you definite and say time is irreversible if there is a small probability that it will
go back the other way?
The other way. Is it that the probability is so low that you just discard it and say, oh, it is irreversible, or should we
consider? Oh, I see what you're saying. I think I see what you're saying. So it's not apparent in the talk I gave because I didn't want to put too many equations. But the important message of the theory is to say that it is not an accident. When time goes forward, it's by definition. So it's not a probability. Even though in the particular algorithm that we wrote, we made in order to make sure that it can never be reversed, we used an element of randomness in the algorithm. The message to pass is that is just to pass the message that events do not ever unhappen. It's not because there's a small probability, it's zero probability, like absolute zero, nothing there. No matter how many zeros you put in front, and there's never a one, it's zero forever. So the arrow of time is, there's no chance of reversal in this theory that we've made. We can talk a bit about it more. Okay, there's one question here. So no, yes.
What rules out a purely anthropic reasoning behind that probability, like if
just go there to that slide.
The initial conditions hadn't been as they were, then we wouldn't exist to observe how the initial conditions were.
Mm-hmm. Remember when I was saying I'm here, speaking in this podium because I didn't fall down the podium and lost the ambulance on the way to the hospital? That's the thing. That's what I was talking about. The multiverse. The problem with that explanation, and you should take this with a pinch of salt, because I and almost anyone in this building are not subscribers to the multiverse, but you will find lots of people who are. The problem with the multiverse or the anthropic explanation is that it is not observed. Not observed. So it's a personal, the anthropic principle has one prediction which is kind of good and believable. I think the most important thing you can do in choosing which one do you believe is your personal taste. So for me, having a universes outside of our own, which are never observed and are never accessible and not testable, is not acceptable for me as an explanation. It's a taste. I don't want to argue about, not with you, but we argue a lot amongst ourselves about the multiverse and the anthropic principle. And I think the best answer you can say is, listen, I want to explain the universe that I see with things that are inside the universe, not with stuff that you're never going to see, and you're here because otherwise you wouldn't be here. Or, you know, if the universe wasn't good for humans, then you wouldn't be here. So that's why, that's the explanation. Define your taste as a scientist, and then you see, well, this is not it. That's not an explanation for me. I'm very happy that others have and accept it. Okay, who is next?
I've asked a few, so I'll go last if there's...
Okay, one more, and then you.
So you were saying how going backwards against the arrow of time, just flat out no, like no chance of ever doing that, and multiverse, for the purpose of this conversation, we're throwing that out. What about going back to the past of another possible history of our universe? So I'm traveling forward in my past. Is that still something that's valid?
Are you talking about the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that that goes in the same bag as the multiverse. I'm sorry. I don't want to be. I mean, this, I know this stuff is fascinating to you guys. The many worlds, again, like I was saying earlier, if you dig deep into it, why was the many worlds proposed? And this is being recorded again, so I hope it's not a problem. The many worlds proposal or interpretation of quantum mechanics is an interpretation saying that I moved my arm this way, and at the moment that I moved my arm this way, there was a split in the universes. And there's another world where I moved my arm the other way. There's another world where I moved my arm the other way. Any possible result of a quantum mechanical interaction creates a new world. And so we live in the world that has this outcome of that interaction. And at every event, new worlds separate and give other outcomes. So you are here today, there's another world where you stayed at home, there's another world where you are traveling somewhere. So all the possible results and outcomes exist. Again, that formulation is made because of the aesthetic sense of quantum mechanical theorists. They wanted to keep their theory time symmetrical. That's why. And quantum mechanics just will not be time symmetrical. No matter what you do to it, twist to it, shake it around, it's really difficult to make quantum mechanical time symmetrical. So there's a lot of good, smart theorists working on trying to make it time symmetrical, and one way is the many worlds. For me, these are worlds, again, that I will never interact with. So I like reality, stuff that we can interact with and explain. Okay, so your question, and then one, and then I think we're going to be done. Yes.
I was wondering, so we were talking a lot about time, obviously, but does it really make sense to think about time at such a small level? Like, is it more, like we talk about entropy and time and entropy being very much related, but is it more so that they're the same thing? Because at like in time is more an emergent phenomenon from like this mm-hmm. small
yeah.
scale.
Yeah, so that's exactly what we are coming to say. All other quantum gravity theories have a regime where there is no time and it emerges.
So it's more so like as we perceive of the succession
yes.
of events?
Yes, yeah, exactly. So time and the time emerges with space, emergence of space-time from a quantum quantum gravity regime where there is no space, there is no time, there's no quantum mechanics interactions. And from those proposals of quantum gravity, they make time emerge. So by putting together little bits of their elements. And that is exactly the thing. Normally, proponents of those interactions agree with the block universe. Oh, I'm sorry, this is my phone. So the block universe has the proposals that have time not as a real quantity at the quantum gravity level, then usually agree with the block universe, and that's so this is completely the opposite of that. Oh, I'm sorry. Gee. Okay, there was one more before we end. Yeah.
If
might sound a bit sketchy and I might be drawing conclusions where R should usually be drawn, but if you think of antimatter as particles kind of a time reverse version of those, could that maybe mean that you don't have to get rid of kind of the equations going back in time, but maybe only give them a different interpretation?
That's a good question, totally. So at the level of quantum particle physics, the equations are all very well tested and they're all time symmetric. I don't think that we could build the world entirely out of just having an antiparticle being formed out of an interaction, but those equations do predict antiparticles and they are created, so those equations are completely time symmetric. Remember that this regime of quantum gravity is way, way down there, more smaller than the standard model of particle physics. So in other words, we, with the model, have to make the equations of the standard model of particle physics emerge and explain and derive them from this little instance of time model.
Is there any kind of attempt to kind of do the, give a different kind of, not discard half the equations, but maybe try to?
I think there is. Yeah. I think there is at the particle physics level. Yeah, for sure. Yes, there is interpretations of antimatter as the solutions that go backwards in time.
Let's take a breath again.